Anybody else excited about the unofficial start of summer? Is that woohoo? You're good with that. It's a good thing. If you want, the snow will come back again in a few months. If you're tired of this already, no, of course not. We're excited. This weekend, my family, had our first s'mores of the year. Yeah, something to get excited about. That's a treat for the summer months. So we had our first s'mores just this weekend on Friday evening. My children are at this strange stage of life. I guess every stage of life is strange in its own way. But they enjoy pretending. And Paxton especially right now, he enjoys pretending to be people. And he enjoys pretending to be animals. He loves pretending to be a puppy. So this is what we're going through right now. But on Friday night, as we lit that fire, and they were off doing their own thing, pretending to be people and pretending to be animals, we lit that fire, and as soon as the marshmallows come out of the house, boom, they're there, and they are ready. So my children are waiting around the fire. We're all turning these sticks, and of course, they all want to be the first ones to have the first s'more. They want to have that first marshmallow right off the fire. So they're kind of going back and forth. They do this. They bicker like an old married couple. So they go back and forth. I want the first one. I want the first one. I want the first one. And I thought, this is a wonderful chance to have a teaching moment. So I sat the children down and I said, Paxton and Hadley, if Jesus was here, he would offer you guys the first marshmallow. And I thought that I had come across as some sort of deep spiritual message for them. And Paxton turns to Hadley and said, Hadley, you be Jesus. That didn't happen. But it could have. Before I forget, allow me to remind you that Stanton Mennonite Church, you are God's children, His beloved. With you, God is well pleased. And I'm excited because we are here in the third week of our sermon series on redeeming Revelation. And I know some of you probably are uncomfortable with some of the things that I've been talking about, but we're really trying to look at this book from a different perspective. Often we grow up and we hear these teachings about how all of the book of Revelation is about the end times, how the world will come to an end. And if you just follow these rules and do these things, you can predict exactly when it will happen. But I won't believe that's the only way to read this book. I've been trying to show you, for those of you that haven't been around, how we can read this differently, because I believe Revelation was written for people in a certain time, in a certain place. It was written to the seven churches in what we call Asia Minor, and it was meant to be a cyclical letter sent from one church to another, talking about specific issues that these specific churches in a specific time and place were suffering from. It's much like what Paul's letters to the churches in Ephesus and Corinth and Rome were used for. Read this, learn, and pass it on. And just because it was meant for that specific time and place, again, it does not mean it doesn't pertain to us today. Because we still read Paul's letters, and they still matter to us today. Now, indeed, the ending of Revelation, chapters 21 and 22, they do pertain to the end times. But I think much of Revelation has already occurred, and we are called to learn from what these churches have done in the past. Now, one of you on the way out of church last Sunday gave me a pretty affirming statement, and I won't name who this person was, because I didn't ask her if I could tell the story. But she said on the way out the door, she said, you know what, Kevin? My parents' generation fought over this book. It divided families and it divided churches. People could not agree on what this was about. So when they could not agree, they left. They separated from one another. It caused divisions, even in my own family. People saw this and experienced. And this person said, my generation, referring to her generation, she said, my generation probably involuntarily chose then just to not discuss it at all. And she said, thank you. Thank you for opening up this book to us once again and doing so in a new and life-giving way. Now, I've said a number of times already in this sermon series, you are very welcome to disagree with me on anything that I say, especially today. I mean, this is not that central to what we have to do and believe. I think it's important, but it's not central. So if you disagree with me, I'm not going to call you names. I'm not going to disassociate myself from you. You will not be excommunicated from this church. I have said, I jokingly said last week, you know, Jesus is not going to meet us at the pearly gate and say to us, you know, he's not going to be there holding a clipboard and say, okay, now tell me, what do you believe the pale green horseman in Revelation represents? If you get it wrong, he's not going to say, I'm sorry, I never knew you. No, that's our salvation is not contingent upon this. Again, I think it's important, and in a couple of weeks, we're going to look at how this plays out practically. I think it's important, but it's not essential that we get this one right. So, some grace for each and every one of us, especially grace for your pastor. Okay, thank you. One other thing I want to note, all of these sermons, if you have not been here for a couple of weeks, if you missed a Sunday or two, everything is posted online like it always is in full text version and also in audio. So if you prefer to read, you can find words. If you want to listen, you can do that as well. And there's a little treat, we'll call it a treat, how humble is that? Treat for all of you today. There's going to be some material that I can't fit into this sermon because it's already so packed full. So I'm going to do a PS to today's sermon. And I'm going to record that on my own time, and I will add that to the end of the audio that Lowell is recording for us right now. And if you really want to know about children, there are children here. If you want to hear about what I'll call right now the harlot of Babylon, there's some strong language that's used there. I don't have a lot of time to get into it. I'm going to go into some of that in this PS. If you want to look online, full text already includes this message on, we'll call her a harlot, because I don't want to use the language that's in the Book of Revelation. Might be, yeah, some little kids will take that word and go home with it, and it's not one you want to use in preschool. So, find that online if you are interested. Alright, anything else? Yes, one more thing I want to note is that some of you have noted that things have been coming hard and fast, a lot of information all at once, and I realize that sometimes this sermon series can feel kind of like this. It can feel like drinking from a fire hose at times. So I am going to slow down today. No promises. I'm going to try to slow down today. Probably give a little less detail, a few more stories. And like I said, if there's anything that you need to go back and look at again, find it online and you can always hear or read what you might have missed as I go into my manic, ultra-fast kind of sermon-speaking language here. All right, so we're going to avoid that today. And instead, we're going to go ahead and look at the text that Marlene read for us from Revelation chapter 4. And many of you, if you were here last week, you're probably wondering, why in the world did we look at Revelation chapter 13 last week, and now we're jumping back 9 chapters to look at Revelation chapter 4? Evidently, Kevin didn't do too well in elementary school when you learned how to count, right? No. Part of what I want you to realize here about the book of Revelation is that Revelation is not linear. It does not, well, it does start in one place and it ends in another place, but the stuff in the middle is not meant to be read as a timeline. What we actually find are two different parallel tracks in Revelation. And within those tracks, there is this cyclical pattern, a spiral almost, where we see something, John goes back to it later, he comes to something else, goes back to that again, and it's just kind of all over the place. And this is most clearly seen in the cyclical nature of the seven seals and the seven bowls and the seven trumpets. So there's this cyclical pattern. So if I seem to jump around a bit in this sermon series, it's okay because it's biblical. So we're going to look at chapter 4, verses 2 and 3 first here this morning. And says here in verses 2 and 3, it says, at once, this is John speaking here, at once I was in the Spirit, and there before me was a throne in heaven with someone sitting on it. And the one who sat there had the appearance of jasper and ruby, a rainbow that shone like an emerald encircled the throne. Now we live in a 21st century democracy, so this might seem a little confusing to us. No, of course not. We know what's going on here, right? There is a throne, there are jewels, this is a king, right? This is pretty clear. You know, who said Revelation is difficult to understand? This is clearly speaking about a king. Now, we probably all think in our minds we know who that king is. But let's just kind of hold that off for a little bit. And think this is a scene in a throne room, the place where the king sits, and there is clearly a king present there. So far, so good. Go on to verse 4. Surrounding the throne were 24 other thrones, and seated on them were 24 elders. They were dressed in white and had crowns of gold on their heads. An important thing for us to remember as we try to understand the book of Revelation is that numbers matter. And numbers aren't just numbers. Often these numbers refer to something else. So the number we find here is 24. And often whenever the number doesn't seem that familiar to you, it's helpful to factor out another number to get a different number. And we know that 24 is a factor of the number 12. 12 times 2 is 24. And the number 12 is very significant in the Bible. In the Old Testament, we find 12 significant in that it is the number of tribes of Israel, the children of Jacob. Throughout the Old Testament, you find these guys again and again, the 12 tribes of Israel. Move to the New Testament, and it's not by accident, I think, that Jesus has 12 disciples. The 12 disciples mirror the 12 tribes of Israel. So these 24 elders that are around the throne seem to be a meshing of the 12 tribes of Israel and the 12 disciples. It's this coming together of both the old and new. They have assembled to worship this king, whoever that king might be. But it's kind of strange to me that these tribes of Israel, these disciples, they have their own thrones. They have their own crowns. And I think this is consistent with the New Testament, where we're taught that we are co-heirs with Christ. This is why they have a throne. This is why they have a crown. I use my handy-dandy Burger King crown here to illustrate. So these gentlemen, they are sitting upon their throne. But do they stay on their throne? No, of course not. They have a crown. Do they leave the crown on their head? No. What do? They take their crowns. They get off their throne. And they get down on the floor, and I'll bring this up here quick. And they prostrate themselves before the king, laying their crowns at his feet. My crown, say that was my throne. They get down, and you probably won't be able to see this well, not only on their knees, down on their bellies, and lay the crown at the feet of the king, whoever that is. Now, you probably can't see me too well, but do I look like a high and mighty, powerful king? No. This is their way of showing subordination to that king. This is their way of praising the great king that sits in the middle. So maybe they are co-heirs with Christ to this kingdom, but they realize they are below that king there. Again, not too hard. Who says Revelation is difficult? I do, because now we're going on. It's going to get weird here, folks. And my rule of thumb is, as it gets weirder, we are allowed to have more divergent opinions on this. We can't say for sure. I'm going to try to use language like some people say or I believe. But know that if you disagree with what these images mean, it's understandable and okay. Verse 6. Around the throne are four living creatures, full of eyes in front and behind. Yeah, sure. That's normal. Earlier this week, I was trying to rush out the door. Trying to get to a meeting. I seem to have had a lot of meetings here lately. And I try to get the children together so we can take them off to the babysitter. And I get Hadley, our 2-year-old. She's ready to go. Shoes are on. I take her out to the car and buckle her in and get the diaper bag. And I set it in the car. I go back in to get Paxton. He's 4 years old. And his favorite game in the world right now is, of course, hide and seek. Yeah. Often when Paxton decides it's time to hide, I let it go for 35, 40 minutes, you know. I can't find you. I'm just going to keep checking my email while I look. You know, stuff like I'm a good dad. but I was in a hurry. And as soon as I walk in the door, I hear, "Dad, you can't find me. You can't find me." I'm like, I'm trying to hurry. I need to get somewhere. So I walk into the living room. And, you know, because he's 4 years old, he's not good at hiding. So he keeps yelling, "You can't find me, you can't find me." I walk into the living room and I say, "You are under the coffee table. Come, let's go. I'm in a hurry." And he comes out and, you know, he does this. It's not fair. It's not fair. How did you find me? So I said to him, I have eyes in the back of my head. We spent the next 15 minutes with him looking at the back of my head, trying to find the eyes. So much for trying to hurry. No, when we say I have eyes on the back of my head, we don't literally mean I have eyes on the back of my head. What we're saying is I know more than you. I see more than you. I'm more aware of my surroundings than you. I have knowledge and wisdom. These creatures possess more knowledge and wisdom, more experience than the average human being. But we look at these individual creatures, and there's one that looks like a lion. There's one that looks like an ox. One that looks like a human, and one that looks like an eagle. And the number of creatures here is significant. Again, there's numbers that really matter in the book of Revelation. How many creatures are there here? Not a trick question. Four creatures here in this scene. The number four is significant in Hebrew culture. Because in the Hebrew culture, whenever they heard the number four, they understood it as a number of completeness, a number of thoroughness, a number of, comprehensive number. In the Hebrew mindset, the world was flat, was not a sphere like we understand it. And this flat earth had four corners. Under each of those four corners, there was a pillar that held it up. What was under the pillar? I don't know. They didn't either. But it was a square earth. So to the Hebrew mindset, when they talked about the four corners of the earth, this is their way of saying, I have gone to all the corners looking everywhere for something. And some people still use this language today. I've heard people say, you know, I lost my keys and I've searched the four corners of the earth looking for my keys and still cannot find them. What they're saying is not that the earth is literally made with four corners. What they're saying is I've looked all over from here to here to here to here and back again and still can't find them. These individual creatures represent a comprehensive nature, all-knowing and comprehensive. But the creatures themselves are significant. The lion is the greatest among the wild beasts, the king of the jungle. The ox is among the greatest of all domestic beasts, especially in the Hebrew mindset. They didn't know about elephants in those days. Eagles, the greatest of all the birds of the air, and human beings, well, Genesis tells us that we are God's crowning creation, God's jewel. The greatest of all creation is the human being. And this is the scene in the throne room. These all-knowing, these wise beings that are comprehensive in their understanding, representing the greatest of all of creation, bow down to worship that king. Now, who is that king? That's a question I'm asking you. Who is that king? That is God. That is God. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jean-Pierre Prévost. I think he was German. That's very French. Jean-Pierre Prévost says that the throne room has been described as a symphony of Old Testament theophanies. A theophany is a way that God reveals himself to God's people. When God reveals himself to Moses in the burning bush, that is called a theophany by pretentious people like pastors. So Jean-Pierre Prévost is saying that this is a symphony of Old Testament theophanies. And I'm going to just show you this slide really quickly. If anybody wants a copy of this, I can email it to you. But we see things like Moses in the burning bush, God sitting on a literal throne, a God appearing in white, surrounded by beauty, presence of the sea, surrounded by fire, smoke, lightning, these angelic beings. These beasts covered in eyes, these were in the Old Testament as well. We see them in Ezekiel 1 and chapter 10 and Daniel 7. So again, when a Hebrew person or a Christian that grew up reading the Hebrew scriptures, anybody that was well-versed in these passages, read this letter, this cyclical letter that was sent to these seven churches, when they received this, they said, oh yeah, it's clear that king that they are worshiping, that is God. But to the average Roman soldier who was out there looking for Christians to arrest them, to persecute them, when they got this document, they're like, what is this? This is mythology. This is fiction. Go on your merry way. This was a way of saying what they wanted to say in code. And the code is simply asking the question, who will you worship? I spoke of the two different parallel tracks that we find in the book of Revelation. There's this parallel track of this beastly worship, worship of the Caesars, worship of the Roman Empire, and there is the worship of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Two parallel tracks. Which one do you want to be on? Now, we in the 21st century, we do not live in an empire, right? We do not have an emperor. And hopefully we do not worship the president of our country. Sometimes there's some past presidents that seem a little bit, and it's a little bit iffy. Some people do seem to almost worship the presidents, but we wouldn't worship them in the way that the Caesars were worshipped. Nobody bows down. We don't build temples. Oh, actually, some of those things in D.C. are a little templish, but I'm just saying, we don't worship these kinds of leaders in the way that the Romans worshipped their Caesar. But we know that anything that we put before our God, anything that we allow to come between us and the worship of our God, we have a name for that. And we call that an idol. That which we put before our God is nothing short of an idol. And it's really easy for us to come up with some things that we make into idols on a regular basis. Money, sex, power, cars, electronics, and I add isms on the end. Isms, I'm using that for shorthand. Anything that we try to elevate, like our personal group, when we elevate our gender over the opposite gender, we call that sexism. When we elevate our race over another race, we call that racism. When we elevate our nationality over another person's nationality, there's a fun word for that. It's called jingoism. Is that new to you? Jingoism. It's a fun word for a sad thing. So, you know, if that German guy, Jean-Pierre, if he said, you know, German is the best country in the world and you Americans stink, you know, that's jingoism. Any way you can elevate your country, your person, your color, your gender above other people, when we make that into an idol, that is not okay. But let's lighten it up here a bit rather than looking at that route. And I want to tell you about my friend Dave. Some of you know Dave King from Eastern Mennonite University. Dave is the athletic director there at that school, just up I-81 in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Dave and I sit on conference council together, and we met not this past Friday, but the Friday before. And Dave and I got together a little bit, had a little chat after the meeting. So good time. I enjoy talking to Dave. Dave is just an interesting guy because he, you know, I joke around. Dave grew up in a very conservative, normal Mennonite kind of setting. But I say that Dave was absent the day that they taught Mennonites to be passive-aggressive. So Dave was just there. He will just tell you what he thinks. And at first it catches you off guard. You expect this guy to, you know, say things really carefully and, you know, not to be too offensive. No, Dave just lets you know how it is. This is just the way he is. And once you get to know him, I think it's really a treat just to talk to him because he's not going to skirt around the issues. Boom, he'll just tell you how it is. And he's often right. So, interesting guy. But Dave is the athletic director at Eastern Mennonite University. That means everything that goes on at Eastern Mennonite University athletic-wise, Dave has a say in it. He's part of that. Everything from the women's field hockey team to the basketball team to the track and field team, soccer, all of that Dave is involved in. The athletic scholarships, I guess they aren't able to give out athletic scholarships, but all of this is something that Dave has his finger in the middle of. The revenue that's brought into the university from athletics, Dave is responsible for that revenue. So he is the athletic director. So powerful guy in a powerful position. Now, Dave has been commissioned by Virginia Mennonite Conference to go around the country to speak on an important topic, something that he finds to be very valuable to Christians. And he has been commissioned to go in and speak on what he has called the idolatry of youth sports. Ooh, the idolatry of youth sports. That is captivating. Now, all of us, well, I mean, I'll just pick on one sport. Youth soccer, traveling soccer teams. Very popular right now among young children. And I could pick any sport, but I was thinking of some of the children in this congregation who aren't here today. Thought maybe they would be engaged with this. But we know that this can be a challenge because traveling soccer, these kids are going around the state and going to different locations and playing soccer, and it's a wonderful thing. But many of us would say that when these soccer matches and the practices, when they start to break up family meals, when you can no longer sit down and have a meal together, we would say that's a problem, right? Sure, that's degrading the family value system. But when that traveling soccer team, when these games and these practices, when they start to break apart the church, and when families cannot come to church and worship on a Sunday morning, Dave said that is idolatry. That is putting youth sports before worship. And he notes that there are some churches that on a Sunday morning in certain seasons, the churches are half empty because of so many families traveling around the country with their young children to play in these games. Now, if I was to stand up on a Sunday morning and make that my main point, many of you would say, well, you know what, Kevin, you're a pastor. You benefit from us being here on a Sunday morning. So you might understand what I'm saying. That might have some value, but ultimately, because I have, because I benefit from you being here on a Sunday morning, it wouldn't mean as much. But for Dave King, who benefits from this culture of sports, for him to come and say, I think that we need to reassess our values, because we're making this an idol. Well, that means a lot more. And I'm glad Dave is actually going to come here in the fall and he's going to give a sermon and hopefully teach Sunday school as well on what he's calling these idolatries of youth sports. Now, I'm a little uneasy comparing youth traveling soccer teams to beastly worship in Revelation 13. Obviously, that's a bit of a leap there. But I think you can see, again, my point is, anything we place before our relationship with God, anything that comes between what God is calling us to do, that's an idol. And that's a different track than what we're called to in Revelation chapter 4. So I want to turn quickly. I might have you out of here on time today. Shouldn't say that. No, don't make idol promises, Kevin. I want to turn real quickly to verse 4. Verse 4 says, day and night, they, that is the creatures and the elders, they never stop saying, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come. In the English language, we have something that we call superlatives. We use language to make, you know, degrees of separation between individual people and items. So we often add something to the end of an adjective or an adverb. Now, I'll give you an example of this. I stand about 6 feet tall. And if I had some of you stand up, I would probably be taller than many of you. So you look at me here today and you might say, Kevin is tall. Everybody say, Kevin is tall. Kevin is tall. Thank you. That's very affirming. Let me show you a picture of a friend of mine. This is Lane McDuffie. He is pictured holding an average-sized human being there. That was a joke. Full-grown average human being, right? No, he's holding his son there. But Lane McDuffie is 6'8". And when I first met him about a decade ago, he told me then he weighed 280 pounds. I think he's filled out a bit then, since then. So he's a good 6'8", 300 pounds. He is a big dude. This is a picture when he took his son to a monster truck rally. And you know what Lane McDuffie calls monster trucks? Trucks. To him, it's just an average truck. No, just to give you a little bit of an idea, the picture is not meant to show scale, but here's some people standing over here to the side. So I thought about Lane a little bit, and I remembered that about 10 years or so, my wife thought it would be really funny to take a picture of me next to Lane. She says, I've never really thought of Kevin as being small, but when I see him stand next to Lane, I do think he is small. And I did a little bit of digging yesterday, and I found this picture. You may notice that I am standing on my tippy toes. And he can still clearly see right over the top of my head. And he's also slouching, leaning back on his car. Kevin is tall. Lane is taller. Okay. Lane lives in Lincoln, Nebraska. Sonia also grew up in Nebraska, where many of her cousins still live. And I say from time to time that Sonia is the runt of the family. She has one cousin who played Division I basketball, and he stands all of 6'10" tall. This is Bobby Kemp. That right there is the top of Bobby Kemp's head. These individuals standing on either side of Bobby Kemp are 6'6". Each one of these blocks is about 6 inches high. So Bobby is clearly much taller than these guys. If he was standing by an average person, if he was standing by me, who you all said I am tall, he would look huge, 6'10". And just so you know, Bobby does not like tall jokes. I learned that the hard way. So Bobby is all 6'10". Kevin is tall. Lane is taller. Bobby is tallest. Those are superlatives. The Hebrew and Greek languages, they're old languages, biblical languages, 2,000 years old. Language has developed a lot since then. But in those days, they didn't have the same superlatives that we have today. They couldn't just add ER or EST to the end of a word to show the degree that something exists. So rather than saying tall, taller, or tallest, they have to get creative. So how is a Hebrew or Greek person supposed to speak of God as being better than all of the other gods? We find ways of doing that, creative ways of doing that in the Bible when we find them saying, these people are servants of the God Most High. We serve God Almighty, God All-Knowing, All-Powerful. These sorts of things exist in the Bible. Or another common way is to repeat the word three times. Holy is the Lord, holier than all others, indeed the holiest of all. This is what's happening in Revelation. In the midst of this beastly worship, when people are bowing down and worshiping that which is not God, this group gathers together and says, holy is the Lord, holier than others, the holiest of all. Let's pray. God, we come here today to worship you because we believe you are the holiest of all. Above all others, above all other things and beings and sports and activities, Lord, there is none more holy than you. And we wish to give you our uncompromising allegiance today. Help us, God, to remember to put you in your rightful place, to lay our crowns at your feet, to prostrate ourselves before you, lay flat on our faces, showing that you indeed are worthy of our praise. Lord, forgive us for when we fail to do so. Help us to do better. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Hi, everybody. It's Kevin. Thank you for tuning in and listening to this podcast. I mentioned during the sermon time that I had a bit of a PS to add to today's message, and I just want to go ahead and do that now. And again, my reason for not going ahead and just saying these few things during the sermon is, one, I actually did get people out of church on time this Sunday. That was the first time in several weeks, so feel good about that, especially on a holiday weekend. I know people had barbecues to get to and other things that they wanted to do with family, so didn't want to go any longer than we are usually scheduled for. But also, there's just a few words here that I don't feel entirely comfortable saying in front of the really small children, or maybe even some of the bigger children. And it's kind of word that if my mom heard me say, she might, even at 34 years of age, she might hold me down and wash my mouth out with soap, right? Anyways, that language will probably be obvious to you here as we go. Again, when we read through the book of Revelation, we need to be thinking how a first century Christian, well versed in the Hebrew Bible, would have heard and understood this material. So when we read through Revelation, we often read about Babylon. And there's this proclamation, you know, Babylon has fallen, especially in chapter 17 and 18, we hear about the fall of Babylon. Now, Babylon was a wonderful, great empire. Wonderful not as in they were really good, but wonderful as in they were huge. They were powerful. And we know the Babylonians, the leaders, they marched their armies up and down the Mediterranean. They took city after city, country after country, town after town. And they were probably not as kind to the people as they could have been, but they could have been, you know, a little rougher with them as well. What they did was they captured the people, and rather than killing everybody off, what they did was they took them and took them back into other countries, spread them out so that they could not find one another, and therefore they could not rally against the Babylonians and start another war. So, you know, Israelites were separated from one another by hundreds of miles, and they had no idea where other people were. So it's a good war tactic, I guess, for those of you that are into that sort of thing. It keeps you from having to kill everybody, but yet it keeps them from coming together and rising up against you. So anyways, the Babylonians, they were taking city after city, town after town, and growing really strong. Now, they became a superpower during this time. And they came in and they took the promised land from the Israelite people. Now, when Jerusalem eventually fell, the Israelites were taken into captivity just like all the other nations who were defeated. But while they were in captivity, the Israelites were forced to conform to the Babylonian culture, to worship the Babylonian deities. And we find this in stories like the story of Daniel in the lion's den. When Daniel would not bow down and pray, he had to be punished. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were thrown into a fiery furnace. Daniel was thrown into the lion's den. This was their punishment for not conforming to the worship style of the Babylonians and worshiping the Babylonian deities. So I think the reason we see Babylon and in the book of Revelation as being such a major theme, really, at least in those two chapters, is because it's really not that big of a leap to go from Babylon to Rome. The Roman Empire was very similar to Babylon. They didn't take the people into exile, but yet they were exiles in their own country. They were forced to do things that they wouldn't normally want to do. So again, we see this code when the writer of Revelation, John, he doesn't want to write something very directly so that it gets the letter carriers caught and tortured or put to death. So he's writing in such a way that when a person reads it, a Roman soldier reads it, they're like, you know, whatever, I don't know what this is about, doesn't really matter. Because Babylon, you know, it had fallen a long time ago. Babylon fell 500 and some years before the birth of Jesus, so probably closer to 600 years till the book of Revelation was written. Babylon was just something that happened in the past, no big deal. Now in chapter 17, there's this strong language that I've been talking about, where we are introduced to a character who is lovingly called the Whore of Babylon. Yeah, a wonderful nickname, right? The Whore of Babylon. And a Christian well-versed in the Hebrew Bible, when they hear Babylon, they're going to assume they're talking about Rome. And when they hear whore, I probably think that they're going to be thinking of the book of Hosea. Now, Hosea was one of those minor prophets that we find in the Old Testament, and it's really easy to skip over Hosea and go on to the more well-known books of the Old Testament, Isaiah, Ezekiel, ones like that. But Hosea is just, it's really an interesting story, because God instructs Hosea to marry a prostitute and have children with her. You know, it's obvious Hosea is committed to the Lord. He's willing to do this because this is what God tells him to do. So Hosea is very committed, but Israel is not. And that seems to be the point. The marriage between Hosea and the prostitute's name is Gomer, kind of like Gomer Pyle, only this is Gomer the prostitute. Gomer is this prostitute, and this marriage between Hosea and Gomer is symbolic of God's relationship to Israel. God is faithful. God has been faithful. God always will be faithful, even though Israel was cheating on God with other gods. So when we read about the Whore of Babylon in the book of Revelation, this is a reference to those who choose to worship, to follow, and to serve the false deity of Rome and her emperors. But like the story of Hosea, the same God who promised to love Israel unconditionally still waits for us to return to his faithful arms. So that's the Whore of Babylon. That's what I have for today, and I thank you for listening.